Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SuiteOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's January 8th, 2025. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We are a DevOps accelerator for AWS infrastructure that helps teams deploy their software faster. And we do this by leveraging our over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle-tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So no matter where you find yourself on this journey, we're here to help your team launch your products faster. Go to cloudposse.com/meet. Again, cloudposse.com/meet to answer a few quick questions, and we'll show you what it can all look like. So how can you maximize today's session? Well, first off, our format is very informal. You can ask as many questions as you'd like. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools like Atmos or modules, this is a great place to ask those questions. For those on the recording, we host these calls live. Don't miss out. Join us by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. Now, I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's session valuable, share it with your team. We'll be posting a recording of this session to our YouTube channel in a few hours. So you'll find that at youtube.com/cloudposse. So let's see what announcements I got here. All right, well, first one is, this was the one Matt shared here. So if you recall, what was it? Now, I guess it's a month or so ago. There was a lot of buzz because Google announced that they had achieved new levels of computation using quantum computing. That sent related stocks up, but now NVIDIA decided to burst that balloon and say the tech is still 15 to 30 years off before it becomes useful. Obviously, I think they have a very strong vested interest in seeing that get pushed for a while. With GPUs by NVIDIA being their cash cow right now. Matt, thoughts?
Yeah, although I mean, I would be shocked if NVIDIA isn't also going to be in the quantum chip, manufacturing space when that becomes mainstream. But I think there's two things. So like one, it could be like, a little posturing on their side, maybe to hide how far along they are or whatever. But I think the point was 15 to 30 years is not, around the corner as like Google seemed to indicate like last, a few months or whatever it was, a month ago. And if you looked at what happened, some like quantum chip manufacturer like stocks, when Google announced that, some of them went up as much as like over 1,000%. In that time frame, and now like a bunch of other ones, as you can see on the screen, looks like they, a bunch of them dropped by, 40 to 50% on this news. So it's interesting. I wonder if the CEO shorted all his competitor stocks before he made his announcement, because he would have made a ton of money if he did that. So. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if the things that you plan to say in your head, is that considered insider trading when you're trading on another stock that may be affected based on what you're about to say? That's an interesting one. I don't know.
Next announcement was if you write a lot of GitHub actions, it can be annoying to find out that you have syntax errors or problems before you push when only after you push those changes up. Here's a nice little linter that I found. I had looked for a linter for GitHub actions some time ago and couldn't find a simple little Go binary that you can install to do that. This is now a new project by Suzuki, who or Shunsuke, that implements that. Now, this guy has just a tremendous amount of cool little utilities and projects you can check out. This was one that caught my attention. Actually, did I recall that this one got merged? It's also implemented as a module as part of a different linter that he has for other kinds of validation. So, kind of cool.
For what it's worth, along the same lines, the VS Code plugin for GitHub Actions actually does a pretty good job of letting you know when there are syntax errors and all that kind of stuff.
What I'm still looking for, and I haven't looked again, is the problem with a lot of these linters is they use JSON schema, and that works fine, but you got to convert the document to JSON, and then you lose line numbers. So it's hard to know, provide useful feedback in the command line tools on what lines are actually problematic.
Yeah. Even like the OPA policy validators and things have that same problem because they just evaluate the policy and tell you there's an error, and often it's not great at telling you the context of where the error is.
And it's just accept, and the
Yeah.
larger that configuration gets, it's just a more intractable problem.
Yeah. At least the VS Code extension that I mentioned puts a red squiggly under the line
It
that's
does,
bad.
yeah.
It's pretty good
I
about
like
it.
that. I,
Yeah.
that has helped me countless times, especially pasting hallucinations from ChatGPT into my workflows.
Yeah.
All right. Another one that caught my attention was this that there are a suspected, based on their analysis, that they observed around what they believe 4.5 million fake stars on GitHub. They achieved this by looking at the behaviors of looking at the fire hose of events coming out of GitHub and the users making the stars, and seeing that the profiles, these profiles, what characterizes them as possibly fake is that they have very little other interactions with GitHub other than liking, meaning that they're not making any commits. They have no repos or things like that. And the other behavior was the kinds of things that Reddit does, which is identifying pools of users that always upvote at the same time. So they were able to see a set of profiles that consistently thumbs up the same repos within the same time windows, making them suspicious. The positive. Oh, sorry, Matt.
I was just going to say that their algorithm, if they are doing that, should be pretty easy to randomize that so that that doesn't happen. That should be like an easy one to counter if they don't want to be detected.
I mean, exactly. Well, it's an arms race as always, and but those would be pretty easy things, yeah, to thwart. Then I guess the only positive thing was it was mostly spam and malware using these techniques to pump up their repos, not legitimate projects. Nonetheless, and interesting, I thought. And interesting, I think that GitHub doesn't do anything about it. I guess there's no real incentive for them.
Yeah, so over my break, I watched, I don't remember where, because I watched a bunch of stuff, but I watched something. Maybe it was on YouTube itself. I watched a video that detailed a basically a YouTube watching farm, and it was literally just thousands of phones
I've seen
that
that.
all
That's
had
cool, yeah.
geolocations in different spots
Yeah.
that would randomly select, different videos from this one channel, and they were just like pumping up the revenue being generated by that channel by watching,
Oh.
and they had these really sophisticated algorithms about like how long to watch for, how often to thumb it up, how often to stop halfway through, like all of these other things. So they were trying to make it extremely hard to detect that they were non-human, non-human users like that are doing it. So the people who own those channels then make, significantly more money when they've got like all these extra thousands of, or millions of views at the end of the day. So thought it was
We talked
pretty
about
interesting.
something similar, or some of the challenges of web scraping, and it was kind of related to that. And how, and in that was an article where they showed a farm of like cellular phones used for installing apps and doing upvotes. And yeah, pretty
But
crazy.
so I've played a lot of poker in my life, including online poker at one point. And one of my good friends works on a security team for, I'll just say, a major poker site. I don't want to say which one. And their job is particularly difficult in identifying those kinds of things, because what they're trying to do is they're trying to identify if you're playing with some sort of like automated software, either software that tracks your opponent's behaviors in real time or analyzes the cards like that are on the table and plays, what is mathematically like game theory optimal like strategy against other players. So they actually do all sorts of what you would consider like malware detection, but they're looking for other things that are like hooking the QT engine to be able to like read the cards, and things that are non-mouse, non-keyboard like inputs, and things that don't be that behave too consistently to be human, that are actually like taking automated actions on the table and all of that kind of thing. So it's a pretty fascinating domain to try to like catch all these types of people like in what is alleged, in that case is actually cheating, like because you're having computer play a human without disclosing that it's a computer. So yeah, so I don't know, interesting.
Which
I'm
would be
always
an
interested.
interesting new form of gambling, maybe. Can there be a bona fide like algorithm versus algorithm poker games for money?
That's actually what they that's what like a lot of the suggestion is now, is that you could have tables or games that are only, well, that are bot whatever allowed. If you want to go in there as a human and play against them, that's, if you feel like you have an exploit against the bot, like maybe you could play against it and try to beat
At
it,
your own risk.
but at least they're disclosing that it's a bot that's playing against you. And you don't have to, you don't have to wonder at that point, what the guy is doing, on the other side. So it's a very interesting space right now. So
All right, next topic was API Parrot. I believe it's just a SaaS, not a particular open source. Oh, download for macOS features use case. Yeah, I don't know if it was free or not. I just thought the concept was really interesting. It's basically a proxy that uses an AI to suss out the structure of those API requests. And the nice thing about modern websites is they're more and more API driven with static front ends. So the APIs can do more and more. And therefore, I think this is an interesting way if you want to try and automate data extraction, for example, from a site. This would make that easier.
I think that was definitely a trend. I think we're actually reversing that trend, and you're finding all the major web front-end frameworks right now, at least in the Java space, in Java space, in the JavaScript space, are strongly moving towards SSR again. Where they're partially rendering, because they can do streaming now, and they can get the browser to render, like partially render pages or fully render pages while the HTTP request is still streaming down to you. They're actually rendering a lot of the data, and all of those things, like in the HTTP request itself, not in a separate AJAX request that's made once the once the static HTML loads and, on DOM ready, triggers or whatever. So I think we're seeing a lot of that reversed. So a lot of it is not necessarily like every action that you can do on a website is not necessarily an API endpoint anymore, which as a developer, that makes it a lot easier, I think, to do that. But and it's probably much more performant, especially on very large, like on very large websites. It becomes much more performant to do SSR. But little tangent, sorry. Yeah, I was just commenting on
No,
your
that's
assertion
interesting.
there.
Well, and if I understood, that was one of the big differentiators between, was it the Astro framework and Next.js? Isn't
The like
Astro entirely?
pretty much every framework now, whether it's Next, Nuxt, Astro, Svelte, like all of these other ones, they've all got some format of SSR at this point. Even the guy that created React Query has Tan, like TanStack, which was renamed to TanStack. He just created a brand new framework called like Tan Start, I think it is, and that's like all like servers like SSR first, is the kind of preferred way to do it. So I think like that's the industry trend right now is that everyone's headed back that way. Pretty soon we'll all be on mainframes again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And all right. Next one was I saw just an via Anton Babenko's newsletter. There was an announcement last year at some point about code build working as runners for GitHub Actions. In reading through this, it was clear it's not for the faint of heart, the initial setup. To get it all working, as you could see by all that. And as I recall, when we looked into it, you couldn't create organizational runners. You had to deploy a configuration for each individual repo. And that was the deal breaker in the end, if I recall. But haven't looked into this anymore. Anyone know? Conclusively? No.
I haven't
Right.
looked at this in a long time.
Are there
Yeah.
any
Yeah.
I haven't looked at that method that you're referring to, but I am curious, are there any like SaaS services that you'd recommend that will just set up GitHub self-hosted runners for you where you don't have to
This one is good. Yeah. Matt
runs
had
on?
one that came up, but Runzon is also really good. They're a rare exception of SaaS that is priced yearly, but at a price that is like, shut up, take my money, and don't worry about it. I think it's like a few hundred bucks or something for a license. And it's a glorified CloudFormation template, and it's entirely managed by you. It's not a SaaS, but it is turnkey, and you don't really need to do much at all to get it running. And it works 10 times better than Actions Runner Controller. And you don't need to manage Kubernetes with it as well.
Oh, so you do have to maintain the template that they give you. Like you have to control the
Well,
application.
they maintain the template, if you will, but and you just run it in your account.
It's a SaaS basically that you
Well,
plug into, sort of.
but they I don't think they actually run servers on their end, to be clear.
No,
API.
yeah.
Yeah. So
Oh,
it's
yeah.
like it is, software as it's
Well,
Blackwell.
they run the management interface that you configure all the stuff in to like do your template thing, right? Isn't there like a thing where you log in and like,
There might be very thin thing
yeah.
to generate a config or something for you. I didn't set it up myself, but if you're curious about it, I mean, Kat, if you were just using Atmos and our reference architecture as you've been talking about doing, this would be an easy thing. So you go to learn and you go to automate Terra or configure GitHub Actions, and then we have a runs on. This is Philips Lab Actions Runner Controller. Where's runs on? I know we have runs on. I think it's right now just the component documentation. So if we go to reference components, AWS, and then runs on, we have a component for it. And you can use those components without Atmos, of course, but everything's easier when you do. So that deploys their CloudFormation template, and you just provide a license key to it, and it works fine.
Cool. And you just deploy it once and basically set it and forget it, I take it.
Yep, set it and forget it.
Cool.
Unlike Kubernetes, Carpenter, and Actions Runner Controller. That is, deploy it and then spend, hundreds of hours a month optimizing.
Yeah, I didn't realize you guys are using a SaaS. I recall you guys had a Terraform module that did this. And
Yeah,
so,
we have a few approaches. We have one simple component that deploys an autoscale group with the agent on there. It works for small teams. It's a simple solution. It's very easy to understand. It's just an autoscale group. The autoscale group scales not based on queue depth, but based on CPU. So it has a naive solution where if the CPU is busy, just keep adding nodes. So more jobs get picked up. And when the CPU is low, that means there must be no jobs, then it scales down. But we've been promoting the Philips Lab Philips Labs runners for a while as also an alternative. That also works pretty well. That works better than Actions Runner Controller. Actions Runner Controller is just a master class in Kubernetes optimization and Actions Runner optimization with a lot of caveats. And there was a major release of Actions Runner Controller that changed how it scales or how it works that I don't know the details on personally, but has cr caused a rift in the community, but also complications in how to use it. So we are pulling back from Actions Runner Controller.
On a somewhat related note, one of the things that RunsOn also makes that I did some research on and pointed my friend in a direction, and he implemented it and said it works really well, is that you can switch out your GitHub cache to be an S3 bucket. So you don't have to pay for all the crazy GitHub storage. And it's actually much faster, my friend said. So I don't know why that is, but I think it runs on has like it's like a GitHub action that you can, oh, there it is, Magic Cache that you can run, and it basically like will cache all of your stuff inside an S3 bucket instead of in the GitHub cache itself.
That's cool.
And he was doing something to warm his cache first. He wanted to know, like, he wanted to like have an external process that warmed the cache for his CI/CD for some stuff he was doing, and that's why he ended up using this, because he could easily figure out how to warm the S3 bucket basically.
That's cool.
Yeah, the
All right.
pricing looks pretty cheap for what you get. Looks like it's a flat rate. So hard to complain at that point.
Yeah, it is. I wouldn't be surprised if he changes it at some point in the future, but at least the way it's priced right now is just to build as much adoption as possible.
Yeah, I mean, you get personal for free, and then if you're a business, it's a flat rate for like 25 euros a month. Looks pretty reasonable. I can't picture myself maintaining this for less than that per year.
Yeah, definitely not.
Yeah, the only thing that I'm curious about with this that I haven't actually tested is what if you block what if you block the license server? Like what ends up happening to your runs there? Because it actually like validates the license with the runs on like server itself. So if you click on architecture right there, that diagram, that's what I was just looking at. So basically they spin up on App Runner, they spin up their server that is the thing that controls like all the scaling and all that kind of stuff. And it has to talk back to runson.com to for like license check and all that. So how long are you're basically putting them in the critical path of your actions running, I guess. And what happens if that like they go down? Like I'm not s suggesting block them for nefarious reasons, like to try to skirt their license. I'm just more curious, like how long can they be blocked for before like your like containers go offline, so that or your EC2 instances go offline and you can no longer run GitHub Actions.
Yeah. All right, let's see. Next, next announcement was just a something forthcoming that I'm excited about in Atmos. So the reason why I wanted to talk about it was I think sometimes it's hard for people to get their head around Atmos because Atmos is not just like one small purpose-built tool. It is a product that does a lot of things for a lot of tools. And one of those things that it does is gives you really a data model that describes your architecture. So let's say you were using Terraform without any other tooling or things like that. How would you find, how could you query your Terraform to get data back and out of it? Well, with Atmos, we make that pretty easy because your entire configuration that describes your architecture is in YAML. We are adding a query argument here. So when you run Atmos describe commands, you can query it for a given path. And if you've ever used the GitHub client, the GH client, one of the nice things it supports is a dash dash JQ argument. So you can extract any data you want absolutely out of the responses from commands using the GitHub client. Well, now you can do that with Atmos, and you just use YQ, which is a riff on JQ for querying that data. So this is a great way to ask any question of your configuration and get an answer without trying to do other workarounds. So you can get all the settings for your VPC in production. You can run that same query and figure out what the variables are. It would be relatively easy to start searching for also, anywhere some variable is set and so forth.
Yeah, so I wrote the Atmos get setting action that we have, the GitHub action, and this would have been very handy for that.
Yeah,
If
just
you look
made
at
that
that,
almost useless.
yeah, I basically piped everything to I piped everything to JQ and then wrote a bunch of like crazy JQ to make sure that it gets all the settings, like basically settings out that you want. So now we don't even need that action. You can just run an Atmos command to get the same info.
And I think this is the trajectory we want to take.
Yeah.
More and more is instead of making more and more GitHub actions. Just build a function or functionality directly into Atmos. And that's the realization or the mea culpa that we've had. All right. That's all the announcements we had on the list here. Any other interesting things catch your attention this week? Somebody said namespace.so. What is that?
Oh, you're pwned.
Remember your build and test times namespace is a purpose-built compute platform that offers you the fastest developer workflow performance. I have to say, Runzon, they got the best name though. Namespace does not evoke what this does. Perry asks, are people getting mad at Honey? What's the backstory there? Is this
Oh,
Honeycomb?
so this was more of a Honey is stealing the forwarding token
It is all over the place about all of these people who were advertising Honey have been getting their commission stolen from them, and they are heated. Every content provider is so mad. Like, there's a class
I think
action
we need to take
lawsuit.
a step back. I've never heard. I when I
Okay,
heard
so
Honey, I
like
was
from the
thinking Honey
beginning,
Comb.
there's a plugin you can get for your browser. So when you check out an item, you click a button, it says check for a coupon, like coupon codes. And it checks for a coupon code. But when it does that, it gets the last click in and it changes the redirect URL so that PayPal gets the commission. So if you redirected from a content provider and they're expecting your commission, so every content provider, like some people really got like advertised for this product because they were like, it's free money in your pocket. You can totally use this and it'll search the internet for your coupon codes and you can save tens, maybe hundreds of dollars. And yeah, they saved them money, maybe, but it was directly out of the pockets for every commission, redirect link everywhere, going straight to PayPal instead. And PayPal's response was not the best.
But I'm surprised this is getting attention now. I mean, this has been around for a while and it's always worked that way, no? I mean, they've always been
Yes, it's just
backing commission.
nobody took the time to look at what was
Oh.
happening. So what you have to do is have this plugin, and at the moment you click the button, it changes it. And so if you're not looking at what exactly it's happening, and it's a very quick refresh behind the scenes, kind of sneaky mode, you don't know it happens. And so it takes somebody who's one, tech savvy, two, has this plugin, and three, has a stake in the game to actually go, hey, what's happening? You don't know that this happens. And so one provider went in and was just like, this is dumb. This is crazy. They've been doing this for years. They've taken money out of my pocket. I can't even guess how much they've stolen from me. And it got traction quick because we're talking about people's livelihoods have been affected.
Yeah.
Yeah, it came to light because there was one guy. There's one guy. His name's like Mega Lag or something like that.
Yeah.
He's a huge like YouTube guy from New Zealand, and he's the one who discovered the thing, and like brought it to light, and he's the one that made the claim, and now they filed a class action suit.
Yeah. And what's even better is the coupon codes that Honey will find are they're only providing the codes that are authorized by the website. So if you are selling stuff and you say, Honey, I don't want you to give better codes than what I want you to, they will totally do that and follow the agreement. They don't actually scan the internet. They scan their database of approved codes per seller.
Yeah, I think I'll only say like this is like everything that you just said is what has been alleged.
Yes, this has
PayPal,
all been alleged, but it
yeah.
looks very damning when this guy walks you through it. Like, I've actually watched the video and
Yeah.
he has smoking gun proof.
Yeah, so I actually heard something different about allegedly the coupon codes are not in the database all the time. Allegedly, if you did not have a coupon code registered with Honey as a company, Honey would find a coupon code and add it to their database. And then it would screw up the marketer's ability to track the different distribution channels they're using for that coupon code. And then they would reach out to Honey and basically work with Honey and actually add a coupon code just for Honey to add
Yeah,
into their database.
I think that's definitely one thing, but I think the one part of the lawsuit that was in there's like two forks or prongs or whatever of the lawsuit. The one is like that they're doing that affiliate link hijacking. So basically they're saying Like if they see like someone else's affiliate code, they'll swap in their affiliate code so that Honey, which is owned by PayPal, gets the affiliate link. But then the second is they were accused of basically like they might know of like a 50% off coupon, but their partner pays them to prioritize a certain coupon when people look for it. That's only 25% off. So when you go and say, show me the best, for Venkat's web store, show me the best coupon you have, they'll show you the 25% off one because you've paid them to prioritize that coupon over anything else. But it's there, but like there's an other, like you have to take multiple steps to see the one that might be the best deal, basically. It isn't the one that automatically pops up or is auto-tried when Honey runs through and tries all the different coupons that it knows about and all of that kind of stuff. So it'll be interesting how this all shakes out. My guess is that there'll be some settlement and we'll never know how it shakes out, but
Interesting. I will save that for later and check that out. Sounds interesting.
yeah.
All right. Let's see. Any other topics we can discuss today? Any questions?
I do have some questions about your various experiences, maybe consulting or companies you work on, successfully implementing a cohesive tagging strategy that didn't get developers to mutiny. Just want to understand if anyone has actually succeeded. And this is not in a greenfield environment. This is like
No.
things already exist and you want to change towards tagging.
Yeah, I think that's a key aspect of this is not greenfield. I mean, I would argue we have a successful tagging strategy in every one of our engagements because we start with it from the ground up. It's embedded into null label and everything there and our conventions to organize it. However, it is a bigger conversation to talk about it in a brownfield environment, especially environment already with tags. And depending on the size of the organization, how to model all that out. So, I'll pause there. Anyone?
I would also add that in large organizations, there are generally like a ton of teams, business units, whatever, that rely on the tagging strategy that's in place too. So like you'll have like project management people like that are tied into there. You'll have cost allocation and finance team that's tied into there. You'll have security and compliance who's tied into that to figure out who owns it. A lot of like the IT service desk is tied to that so they can figure out like who the ownership is of certain services or certain servers if things come up with it. So even if you come up with a new strategy and you can figure out how to get the tags onto the resources, that's probably only like a quarter of the battle, or maybe half the battle, in very large organizations. They're often like systems that rely on all these things and the AWS billing and cost analyzer and like all of those things too. Like, so there's usually tons of stuff that's tied to that tagging data. Sometimes even policies, IAM policy has that as condition fields too. So there's a lot of there's a lot to be thought of when you go to switch that strategy up.
So Isaac, it sounded like you're having some experience or about to. Do you know or can you share any more details about it? Like, what are the problems that you're encountering?
Oh no, I'm not encountering any specific
Okay.
problems, but I was discussing with a colleague who is trying to embark on this and.
Oh, okay.
Well, not a colleague, but someone in our industry was trying to embark on this in a different company. And I know that I failed miserably when I tried to do this at my former company. So I was curious about like how do people actually succeed doing at implementing this kind of a change? Because ultimately his desire is to use tagging for a lot of security purposes, right? So AWS has all the ABAC stuff that you can really get fancy. I know not all services support those condition keys and whatnot. But I can see the vision and see how it would really simplify, the job of someone trying to manage and corral security for an AWS account with tagging and people only seeing resources that they should see and all of that stuff. And I'd just like to have, watch someone succeed at it and gain some insider experience so that if I ever have to do that in the future, I can also.
Okay.
But that's background.
I think it really depends, going back to what Matt said, is who is involved in this and who has a stake in it, and that's going to determine how easy or hard it is. I think what you're describing in terms of using it for IAM and authorization is possibly a very different beast to solve than doing it for cost allocation, which might be a little bit more straightforward and less controversial, especially if there are existing conventions. But, unless, yeah, Matt's shaking his head, I guess reading between the lines, because that also determines who's going to pay for it. And some people might not want to pay for it.
Well, and in very large organizations, I've often seen where they get into shares, basically, like when they have shared resources, like as an example, like you're paying, $1,000 a month for like DNS domains and queries and whatever, then they actually try to figure out how to slice and dice that $1,000 across like all the organizations that are or all the services that are relying on that DNS, and give them each a fraction of the share of that $1,000 internally. I once worked on a project for like HP, where there was a team. I wasn't on the team, but there was a team of like 15 people whose sole job it was to like charge back like services, shared services, like within the organization. So moving the money around like within the divisions, like within cost centers inside of HP, which is like crazy. So people, I've seen it go really crazy and really far. And I don't know. I get anytime I think about tags and having to use them for those types of things, it like makes me like shiver a little bit. Like, oh, I'm glad I don't have to do that as my job.
All right. Any other questions we can get to today?
Yeah, I do have a different one. Has anyone used Spiffy at all?
No.
Heard about it. Sounded pretty cool for MTLS, right? From HP, I think.
Yeah, it's a way to issue certificates for your workloads, and you can, it's with an E. You can then use that for
Yeah, I'm not sure if
application.
it's. I was thinking that it's part of like a service mesh, like Aceto or one of the other ones would support it, but I have not deployed it myself. It seems pretty cool though.
Yeah, I know. What the heck is the thing on AWS? App Mesh supports it as well. Like, there's a lot. It's becoming like the standard, or a standard, I should say, that a lot of these service meshes are supporting as a way to do it.
What would be helpful for me to understand is why this over some of like the more mainstream approaches, arguably Istio.
I mean, Istio is a service mesh, right? This is just
Yeah.
the
But this is just handling the one small aspect of that, the MTLS portion of it. But Istio does MTLS. Why have a specific thing that only does this one thing?
I think part of the idea is to have one service that you can use everywhere. So not just identities for things in Kubernetes. It can be identities for your VMs. Be an identity for if you start a code space in GitHub and you want it to have an identity, so for instance, give it AWS credentials or connect to your VPN
I see.
or whatever,
Okay.
you can use Spiffy for that reason to solve that problem.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the question you're really asking, Eric, is why why use an open protocol over a proprietary one? I mean, that's really what it's coming down to. Like, Spiffy is meant to be the open protocol that all these other tools use to do this, versus each one having their own custom
Implementation of
implementation
that. Okay,
of
got it.
the how that all works. So I think that's the TLDR
So
on.
is it like, so are you saying what hypothetically, if Istio were to be started today, they would just use Spiffy for the MTLS portion together with Envoy and the rest of what it does. It doesn't need to implement that logic. Okay.
Yeah, and basically it's just like it's just like a whatever, a standard, right? And it's
Yeah,
basically
I
saying
got you.
like, here's how you should issue
Yeah.
workload-based identities. I mean, I think that's the idea, the idea
That's helpful.
behind it.
Yeah, I didn't get it originally, but that makes sense.
And the other thing is it doesn't it doesn't rely on host names or IP addresses. Right. So you actually get they're portable basically along with the workload that's running on it. So I think that's the key like takeaway of why everyone thinks it's better.
Very cool.
And those of us that have forgotten to add, CNs or, an alternate principal SPNs and all that kind of stuff to certificates over the years, we'll say like this seems better where each workload gets its own unique identity, and then you can authorize all those identities in certain places.
Graduate projects of CNCF. Well, right. Any other questions?
I have one more since no one is asking. Can
Right, fire away, man. Thank
I?
you.
Okay. I've been thinking a lot, I've been doing a lot of DevOps, and my current role, I do a lot of DevOps, but also spending a lot more time on the DevSecOps side and thinking about security and all of that stuff. And one thing that I am wondering is, at lots of companies have been, bigger companies have more of the financial ability to do this, but spend a lot of money on security software, software that is supposed to keep, things safe, cloud security, et cetera. I'm not going to name names because I don't want to get into that. And yet we still have all these breaches. And I just wonder, are these things even useful if they're not really making any difference, right? That's one. And then the other is, I wonder, what do smaller companies do for their security, right? They can't afford these big names, Synapse and all whatnot. So what is a 100-person, 150 small business or startup? Or do they just assume that no one is going to attack them because they have nothing to va of value? So just swirling in my mind.
For us, I think we are trying Akido. It's like a Belgian startup, and it's doing like all-in-one security. And their pricing model kind of acceptable comparing to the big names. And before that, we are actually testing Akido right now, not fully using it, but testing it. Before that, we heavily use like the open source one for anything. Like for a backend in Go language, we look into the open source stuff for that one. And yeah, it's hard. You need to build your own security tools around it, I
Yeah,
guess.
I think Isaac's point is more like not specific details, but when you have all of that done, will you still feel safe and secure? And how much is that costing you as a company to implement both with the human resources and